Hello, my name is Sandy Nelson. I'm an infectious disease provider at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, and I will be speaking about penicillin allergy. I have no financial relationships or conflicts of interest. I just want to start with a premise. About 10% of the United States population has a penicillin allergy label, and the frequency of labeling is higher among those who are chronically ill or frequently hospitalized, residents of skilled nursing facilities, and those are the ones who are usually in greatest need of antibiotics. Now, we know that the vast majority of patients with penicillin allergies can be made to tolerate penicillin or related drugs, provided that they're tested and evaluated appropriately, and this is what this is about. There's definitely been an emphasis over the last several years on penicillin allergy delabeling, and this is definitely a topic that is an important question for the boards. Now, the reason that we can think about penicillin allergy delabeling is that not all patients who have a label will react when administered a penicillin or related drug. There are times that the patient may not have truly been allergic. The allergy may have been a mislabel. And there may be times that a patient may either outgrow the allergy, it wanes over time. And there are certainly some allergies that, even when true allergies, don't recur upon rechallenge. We also know that patients with penicillin allergy are treated with antibiotics that are either more broad spectrum, they may be less effective, they may be less toxic. And so penicillin allergy has been associated with a number of adverse outcomes, including higher risks of resistant organisms, C. difficile colitis, and an increased risk of surgical site infection. So the approach to a penicillin allergy really depends upon multiple factors, with a detailed history of the reaction being paramount. The relevant factors include the nature of the reaction. Was it a rash? Was it GI intolerance? The timeline of reaction, both when it occurred in relation to the drug exposure and also how long ago the reaction occurred, and the severity of the reaction. And we also then may approach the allergy differently depending on whether there's an imminent need for the penicillin or related drug, or whether it's more of a theoretical risk that we are delabeling for the potential for a future need. So we'll go ahead and start with our first question. We have a 44-year-old woman, previously healthy. She was hospitalized with septic arthritis of the knee due to Streptococcus dysphylactiae. After surgical debridement and several days of IV ceftriaxone, she was discharged on high-dose oral amoxicillin. 2 weeks following her discharge, she developed fever and malaise, followed by a generalized rash described as maculopapular, involving her torso and extremities. On exam, the rash had become confluent in areas and involved more than 50% of her skin. There was no mucosal involvement. Other notable features including facial edema associated with facial rash and generalized lymphadenopathy. The surgical incision was healing well and there was no effusion or erythema. I'll let you take a look at her laboratory studies. So what do you advise in this situation? Should you continue amoxicillin with close monitoring? Should you stop amoxicillin and transition to oral cefadroxil? Or does she need to come into the hospital, stop amoxicillin and resume IV ceftriaxone? Should she stop amoxicillin, start vancomycin? Or should she do all of those and also start corticosteroids? I'll give you a few seconds to think about this answer. The correct answer to this question is that she should be admitted to the hospital. This is a severe drug reaction. It describes an individual who has the DRESS syndrome, drug reaction, eosinophilia, and systemic symptoms, which is a severe cutaneous reaction. And this really needs to be treated not only with discontinuation of the offending drug, but also with corticosteroids. This is also an indication to avoid beta-lactam therapy, both at the time of the reaction and in the future. So the most common form of a penicillin allergy is rash. And we're going to spend a few minutes just unpacking the different types of rashes, because those have different implications for management. Some rashes, as you know, are in fact dangerous, as was seen in the last case, but others, many of them in fact, are benign. The first type of rash that we think about is IgE-mediated reactions, or urticaria, sometimes referred to as hives. One of the challenges is that patients, when describing their rash, oftentimes use the terms rash and hives interchangeably. We can't necessarily infer, therefore, that the patient who states that they had hives actually had true urticaria. True urticaria are IgE-mediated reactions. They generally occur within minutes to up to a few hours in a patient who has previously been sensitized. Clinically, you see that characteristic wheal and flare appearance. Each individual lesion usually resolves within 24 hours, although new lesions can continue to occur for days following drug discontinuation. The next form of common rash is a benign T-cell mediated reaction. These occur later, usually days to weeks after starting therapy. They're oftentimes described as maculopapular. They may be morbilliform. They're usually, but not always, pruritic. Usually when in this situation, the patient is well, other than maybe itching. The rashes are generally considered benign. It is reasonable to treat through if there is not a good alternative therapy when these occur. And it is not necessarily a contraindication to future use. But there are several types of drug reactions that are dangerous, and these need to be recognized. I do think that these are prime topics for the boards. I'm going to discuss three reactions, which are called severe cutaneous adverse reactions, sometimes abbreviated as SCARs. These are all T-cell mediated reactions, so they do occur later. They're not immediate reactions. And there's these three types that have long names, but fortunately they have acronyms. These are the drug reaction with eosinophilia and systemic symptoms, sometimes called DRESS syndrome, acute generalized exanthematous pustulosis, or AGEP, and then the final one being Stevens-Johnson syndrome with or without toxic epidermal necrolysis. All of these share a number of features. Not all of them, not all patients will have all elements, but these are the features that should be recognized as potentially alarm symptoms that might make you consider one of these severe cutaneous adverse reactions. And these include blistering, so blistering of the skin, mucosal involvement, severe skin desquamation. Of course, it's not unusual in the setting of resolving edema for skin to desquamate, but if severe disruption of the skin architecture is a significant part of the reaction, that is an alarm finding. And then, of course, the presence of organ involvement, such as kidney injury, elevated liver studies, et cetera. We're going to talk a few minutes on each of these. The first being DRESS, which was the patient in the case that I discussed was a patient who did have DRESS syndrome. The typical onset is 10 to 14 days after drug exposure, but it may be longer, up to 6 to 8 weeks. The rash is oftentimes described as morbilliform, but it may actually be pleomorphic. Sometimes these rashes can be annular, they may be targetoid, they might be pruritic, but oftentimes over time, the rash tends to coalesce and leaving the patient with more large areas of erythroderma. There is mucosal involvement and desquamation at times, but they're not universal. There are two features that can help to distinguish DRESS from other types of drug reactions. These include the presence of a erythematous facial edema. So if they have facial edema associated with rash, that's oftentimes a clue to DRESS syndrome, involvement of the face being a little bit less common with other benign reactions, and also the presence of generalized lymphadenopathy. As part of the definition, individuals with DRESS syndrome do have organ involvement, typically renal disease, hepatic disease, elevated liver studies being the most common, but other organ systems can be involved, including myocarditis, pulmonic involvement. Eosinophilia is part of the diagnosis, but it doesn't need to be severe eosinophilia. Sometimes people will have absolute eosinophil counts of less than 1,000, but still meet criteria based on the other indicators. Now, the most common implicated antimicrobials are not beta-lactams, although beta-lactams can certainly cause DRESS syndrome. Among antibiotics, the most common culprits are vancomycin and trimethoprim, sulfamethoxazole. These patients generally are quite ill. Sometimes they may be hypotensive. They generally require hospitalization to ensure safety over the early window of time. And in addition to drug discontinuation, these are patients who require corticosteroids, usually for many, many weeks. AGEP, or acute generalized exanthematous pustulosis, is another of the severe cutaneous adverse reactions, although a little bit less severe than its cousins. The onset of symptoms tends to be earlier, usually within a few days of drug exposure. And the characteristic finding is that of acute onset of generalized rash, the rash is usually just localized areas of erythema with edema. You get these macules that are become raised, and then on top of them are these tiny pinpoint pustules. So these tiny pustules on an erythematous edematous base would be characteristic of AGEP. You can see mucosal involvement and organ involvement, desquamation, but that's less common than with both DRESS and Stevens-Johnson syndrome. And this one is also somewhat more benign in that it usually resolves without systemic corticosteroids or other immunomodulatory therapy, but oftentimes topical steroids are utilized. The final one I wanted to speak to is Stevens-Johnson syndrome. This one has a variable onset of days to weeks after drug exposure. Patients may have a prodromal syndrome that appears like an upper respiratory infection, or that prodromal syndrome may occur concomitant with the onset of the rash. The rash also evolves over days. It oftentimes starts out as a macular rash, but then may become purpuric or targetoid. And then these areas tend to coalesce into areas of flaccid bullite, and these bullite can then decompress, leading to broad detachment and desquamation. If you put pressure adjacent to the areas of bulla, you may be able to lead to skin separation, which is otherwise called the Nikolsky's sign. Mucosal involvement is common, most commonly the oropharynx, but we can also see involvement of the ocular region and the genital region. And among antimicrobials, again, beta-lactams are implicated, but trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole is the most common antimicrobial associated with Stevens-Johnson syndrome. Patients with SJS are often quite ill. Many of them will need management in a burn care center because of significant skin loss. And in addition to withdrawal of the offending drug and localized wound care, these patients are typically treated with either glucocorticoids or other immunomodulatory therapy. So we will go to our next question. A 73-year-old woman is undergoing chemotherapy for cholangiocarcinoma. She's hospitalized for a bacteremia and sepsis due to an ampicillin-susceptible Enterococcus faecalis. She's currently receiving IV vancomycin but has had progressive renal injury. She does have a history of allergy to amoxicillin. It's listed in the records as rash. The family does recall that she went to the emergency department when the rash occurred and that that was about 3 years ago. She unfortunately is not able to corroborate the history and no additional documentation is available. So what would you suggest be done? Would you administer IV ampicillin without any prior testing? Would you recommend a skin test for penicillin reaction? And then if negative, administer ampicillin? Would you do a skin test and then if negative, administer a test dose to ampicillin before administering full dose ampicillin? Would you proceed to desensitization or would you continue alternative therapy? All right, I acknowledge that this is a bit of a difficult question and you could argue that there are several defensible options, but I do think that the best answer is C, skin test for penicillin reaction, and then if negative, perform a test dose for ampicillin. So I think in the next several slides, I'm going to unpack the options for approaching penicillin allergy and why I think this is the best answer. So when faced with an individual with a history of penicillin allergy, there are several options that are available for evaluation of that allergy. The first is a monitored oral challenge, simply the administration of the implicated drug. This is generally appropriate in low-risk patients, oftentimes in outpatients, but it can be done in inpatients in a very low-risk scenario. The next option is penicillin skin testing, which is really relevant only for reactions that are suspected, either known or suspected to be IgE-mediated. It's useful for both inpatients and outpatients with a history suggestive of an IgE-mediated reaction, but it can also be used in unknown reactions when there is a patient who is sick, such as that patient in our case, or in a patient who may be higher risk. So penicillin skin testing consists of percutaneous and then intradermal testing using the dominant penicillin antigen, which is PPL or benzyl penicillium polylysin, and often a second minor antigen, in this case, penicillin G. These are then paired with positive and negative controls. As you can see in this picture, we have a histamine control and a saline control. A wheal at the site of the inoculation with surrounding erythema indicates a positive test. Because the positive predictive value is not 100% with penicillin skin testing, there are minor antigens that can lead to reactions. It is best to follow a negative penicillin skin test with a graded challenge to the implicated drug or to the drug that is desired. So that is the third option, which can be used either after negative penicillin skin testing, as we discussed, or sometimes as a first step in a lower risk reaction. In general, in this case, a low dose, usually a quarter to a tenth of the dose of the drug is administered. And as long as that is tolerated well, then this can be followed by a full dose about an hour later. The final option is desensitization, and this is done when a patient has a positive skin test or confirmed immediate reaction, but still requires a penicillin drug. It can also be used if there is no access to penicillin testing, although fortunately that has been less of an issue of late. So essentially this procedure exposes the patient to increasing doses of an antibiotic over a short period of time, and induces a temporary state of tolerance of the drug. The individual who receives and tolerates a drug through desensitization is still allergic to the drug. They've just been desensitized. And there are other factors that make this a little bit less appealing. It is quite labor intensive. It oftentimes requires that the patient be monitored in an ICU setting. And it's difficult to maintain, especially after hospital discharge, because any missed dose generally requires repeat desensitization, or at least three half-lives of a missed dose will require desensitization. Those are the options for approaching a penicillin allergy, but of course, there's always the option to consider alternative therapy. And I specifically want to discuss the use of cephalosporins in individuals with a penicillin allergy. Now, fortunately, we know that the rate of important cross-reactivity between the two are low. It used to be that cross-reactivity was thought to relate to the beta-lactam ring, but we now know that the side chains, and in particular, the R1 side chain of the cephalosporin, is really the most important factor. In the setting of a true IgE-mediated penicillin allergy, the overall rate of cross-reactivity with cephalosporins is low. It is higher in drugs that share a structurally similar side chain. And in those cases, if there is an option to use a structurally dissimilar cephalosporin, that can be considered in patients with a penicillin allergy. Structural similarity, I should indicate, refers to the side chain. And although there's not a strict correlation, for the purposes, I think, of the board, it's generally reasonable to consider first and second generation cephalosporins as structurally similar, and third and fourth generation cephalosporins is structurally dissimilar, although I will say it's not a perfect correlation. Now, of course, if there's a history of a mild cutaneous reaction, then any cephalosporin can be administered without prior testing. But if there is a severe reaction, such as those that we discussed to penicillin, then cephalosporins should be avoided. So now we're gonna put all of this together and think about the way that we approach each of these individual scenarios now that we understand the way that they present, and the management strategies. So if you have an individual with a history of an IgE-mediated reaction, yep. If the history is suggestive of isolated urticaria, so urticaria without anaphylaxis or angioedema, then there's really two approaches. If penicillin or an early generation cephalosporin is indicated, then it's recommended to use penicillin skin testing. If the skin testing is positive, then the patient should undergo either desensitization or receive alternative therapy. If the skin testing is negative, then they should receive a test dose either to amoxicillin or to the desired drug. We're going to call that bundle the penicillin skin test pathway. It's also safe in a patient with isolated urticaria without angioedema or anaphylaxis to administer non-cross-reactive cephalosporins. However, if there is either extensive urticaria or urticaria with associated severe symptoms, anaphylaxis, angioedema, those patients are really only eligible for the penicillin skin testing pathway. For patients with a benign T-cell mediated reactions, those are those rashes that may occur several days to weeks after exposure, but without associated alarm features or organ involvement, any cephalosporin can be administered. If a penicillin is indicated, then it's generally best to do this with an oral challenge to amoxicillin or the desired drug. As we've discussed, if there's a severe cutaneous adverse reaction, the recommendation is to avoid all beta-lactams, penicillins, and cephalosporins. And then there's this sort of catch-all category of allergic reactions for which the mechanism may be either immune complex or antibody mediated. And these are types of allergies for which we don't have good testing, nor do we have a good ability to predict the future risk of a reaction. So in general, this is a case-by-case scenario. And if there is a severe allergic reaction, somebody developed severe interstitial nephritis, for example, in general, we would recommend avoidance of beta-lactams. But this can be considered on a case-by-case basis, considering the severity of the reaction and the timing. How remote was that reaction? All right, we're going to go to our third question. We have a 35-year-old woman. She presents to your primary care clinic with sore throat and fever. Two of her school-age children were recently diagnosed with strep throat. On exam, she has no fever, but she does have pharyngeal erythema, tonsillar exudate, and bilateral cervical lymphadenopathy, and not surprisingly, her rapid group A streptococcal testing is positive. She reports a history of penicillin allergy. It occurred when she was a child. She doesn't remember the reaction, but she was told that she shouldn't receive penicillin and doesn't, to her knowledge, think that she's received penicillins or cephalosporins since. So these are your options. Would you recommend amoxicillin with a monitored first dose? Or would you prescribe clindamycin, cefalexin, or azithromycin? And your final option would be to refer her urgently to the allergy clinic. So I'll give you a few seconds to think about that. In this case, I would suggest that amoxicillin could be safely administered, with a general guidance be that this be done with a monitored dose, although I do think that that is not universally applied. And just to consider the other options, clindamycin is no longer recommended empirically given high rates of resistance in strep pyogenes. There's nothing wrong with Cephlex, but it is more broad spectrum, and amoxicillin should be able to be administered safely. And then finally, azithromycin is second line and should really only be used when penicillins can't be used. So this case describes a common scenario in which an outpatient in need of beta-lactam therapy has a reported penicillin allergy. We now understand through a variety of studies what are the predictors that an individual who has a penicillin allergy label will actually have a reactive penicillin skin test. And there are now clinical decision tools that can help the clinician understand whether and how to approach the penicillin allergy. Now, there are a number of scoring systems that have been developed, but the one that is in most widespread use is the PENFAST score. I do think that this is now common enough that it could be asked on the board. And the way that I would try to remember this is both the risk factors or the factors that the PENFAST criteria are assessing, and then how to score them, whether or not a patient would be amenable to an oral challenge. And so thankfully, those four clinical elements can be easily remembered through the FAST acronym, the penicillin, the FAST part of the PENFAST score. So F stands for 5 or fewer years since the reaction. Of course, patients who have had a more recent reaction are at higher risk of having a reaction when rechallenged. The next categories are bundled together, at least from the scoring points, but they're two separate questions. A, has the patient ever had anaphylaxis or angioedema? Was that part of the reaction? Or did they have one of the severe cutaneous adverse reaction? If either of those are present, then that accrues 2 additional points. And the final one is treatment required for the reaction. Did that patient have to go to the emergency department? Did they need any specific treatment other than continued observation and monitoring? And if that's so, that's 1 point. And then you add up those points. And current studies suggest that there are fewer than 3 points, so 0 to 2 points, that those patients could generally receive an oral challenge. So if you apply the PENFAST criteria to the patient that I just described, actually this patient did not have any points in the PENFAST scoring. So this would be a patient for whom oral challenge would be low risk. The final question is a 43-year-old man with diabetes. He's hospitalized with a closed tibial fracture. 3 years ago, he was treated for a diabetic foot infection and received cefepime, and he developed a very pruritic rash after several weeks. Now that he is in the operating room, the anesthesiologist calls to ask advice about surgical antibiotic prophylaxis prior to operative fixation. So how do you counsel your anesthesiologist? Do you recommend the administration of clindamycin, cefazolin following an intraoperative test dose, ceftriaxone, or vancomycin? And I will give you a few seconds to think about your answer. Okay, the best answer in this case is B, administer cefazolin and no test dose is required. Now, the standard of care for surgical prophylaxis, as you know, is cefazolin, and any alternative cefazolin is inferior. So if there is a safe pathway to cefazolin, then that should be employed. Clindamycin, there is unnecessary, there's both inadequate coverage now that we're seeing higher rates of staphylococcal resistance. And we know that outcomes are diminished both with vancomycin and clindamycin in terms of SSI or surgical site infection risk. Ceftriaxone is also more broad spectrum and generally not used for surgical prophylaxis. But in this case, cefazolin is not contraindicated because it doesn't share any side chains with cefepime, and therefore none of these alternatives are needed, nor is test dose administration needed. So just a word on cephalosporin allergies. These are distinct from penicillin allergies. The allergies actually arise most commonly from those side chains rather than the beta-lactam ring. And the probability of cross-reaction to a cephalosporin reaction depends on the relatedness of the R chain, particularly the R1 chain. Now, there are tables. I imagine most of you are familiar with these very large tables, which are available. And they compare these drugs according to their side chain profiles. indicating which drug the reaction occurred to and whether or not an alternative cephalosporin is safe. I don't think it's likely that you're going to need to remember everything on those tables, but I do think that there are a couple of testable points. And what I have listed here are some of the paired R1 side chain groups, and those are pairings for which you could consider the possibility of cross-reactivity. So I remember that amoxicillin and cefadroxil have cross-reactive side groups. Similarly, ampicillin and cefalexin. Cefepime, ceftriaxone, the third and fourth generation cephalosporins all interact with the exception of ceftazidime, although ceftazidime shares side chains with sifidricol and aztreonam. And just as a reminder that if the reaction was a severe cutaneous adverse reaction, that we would recommend avoidance. So this is really only relevant for rashes that are not severe reactions. So I'm going to close with what I would say are just a few more testable points. One is that you can have a selective allergy to the aminopenicillin. So aminopenicillins include ampicillin and amoxicillin. And there are patients that tolerate penicillin that may still be allergic to that amino side group, so to the aminopenicillin. So you cannot infer that tolerance of penicillin predicts tolerance to amoxicillin, which is why when we use test doses, we usually will use a test dose to amoxicillin, because that then also clears the individual to receive an aminopenicillin. But if a patient tolerates an aminopenicillin, then you can infer that they are not allergic to penicillin. Cefaclor, one of the first generation cephalosporins, is associated with a unique reaction, primarily in children. It's generally a serum sickness reaction. It also, we see more common sort of urticarial reactions in children. And it's important to know, particularly that the serum sickness reaction is an isolated response to cefaclor and doesn't predict cross-reactivity with penicillin or other cephalosporins. Cefazolin has different side chains from all other cephalosporins, so it can be administered in patients with IgE-mediated reactions to penicillin. If that IgE-mediated reaction is a severe reaction, so anaphylaxis, angioedema, then a test dose should be administered. But if not, then generally a straight usage of cefazolin can be considered. As we discussed, ceftazidime does not share side chains with third and fourth generation cephalosporins, so generally can be used in a patient who's had reactions to ceftriaxone or cefepime. Likewise, aztreonam can be safely used in individuals with beta-lactam allergies, with the exception of those who have had reactions to ceftazidime or cefiprocol. With that, I will close. Please don't hesitate to reach out if you have any questions. Thank you for listening, and good luck on your exam.